Part 6, Psychology, Diagnoses. While Ted Bundy was on trial in Florida, he was evaluated by several psychiatrists and mental health professionals, and, while results varied, most were able to agree that he had antisocial personality disorder and narcissistic personality disorder. Antisocial Personality Disorder. Source: pubmed.ncbi.nlm.nih.gov. Antisocial personality disorder is a deeply ingrained and rigid dysfunctional thought process that focuses on social irresponsibility with exploitive, delinquent, and criminal behavior with no remorse. Disregard for and the violation of others' rights are common manifestations of this personality disorder, which displays symptoms that include failure to conform to the law, inability to sustain consistent employment, deception, manipulation for personal gain, and incapacity to form stable relationships. The following are criteria to be diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder: a pervasive pattern of disregard for and violation of the rights of others since age 15 years, as indicated by three or more of the following: failure to conform to social norms concerning lawful behaviors, such as performing acts that are grounds for arrest; deceitfulness, repeated lying, use of aliases, or conning others for pleasure or personal profit; impulsivity or failure to plan; irritability and aggressiveness, often with physical fights or assaults; reckless disregard for the safety of self or others; consistent irresponsibility; failure to sustain consistent work behavior or honor monetary obligations; lack of remorse; being indifferent to or rationalizing having hurt, mistreated, or stolen from another person. The individual is at least age 18 years. Evidence of conduct disorder, typically with onset before age 15 years. The occurrence of antisocial behavior is not exclusively during schizophrenia or bipolar disorder. Narcissistic personality disorder. Source: psychcentral.com. Narcissistic personality disorder is characterized by a long-standing pattern of grandiosity, either in fantasy or actual behavior, an overwhelming need for admiration, and usually a complete lack of empathy towards others. People with this disorder often believe they are of primary importance in everybody's life and to anyone they meet. While this pattern of behavior may be appropriate for a king in 16th century England, it is generally considered inappropriate for most ordinary people today. People with narcissistic personality disorder often display snobbish, disdainful, or patronizing attitudes. For example, an individual with this disorder may complain about a clumsy waiter's rudeness or stupidity, or conclude a medical evaluation with a condescending evaluation of the physician. In layperson terms, someone with this disorder may be described simply as a narcissist or as someone with narcissism. Both terms generally refer to someone with narcissistic personality disorder. Professor of Psychiatry Dr. Dorothy Ottner Lewis said, "I always tell my graduate students that if they can find me a real, true psychopath, I'll buy them dinner. I never thought they existed. But I think Ted may have been one, a true psychopath, without any remorse or empathy at all." Dr. Hervey Cleckley, who is considered to be the father of psychopathy, interviewed Bundy while he was on trial and diagnosed him as a psychopath. Psychopaths are social predators who charm, manipulate, and ruthlessly plow their way through life, completely lacking in conscience or feeling for others. They selfishly take what they want and do as they please, violating social norms and expectations without the slightest sense of guilt or regret. The 16 criteria that Cleckley created to diagnose someone as a psychopath includes being hot-headed, manipulative, exploitive, irresponsible, self-centered, shallow, unable to bond, lacking in empathy or anxiety, likely to commit a wide variety of crimes, more violent, more likely to recidivate, and less likely to respond to treatment than other offenders. Of course, Bundy was evidently all of the above. He was also diagnosed as a sexual psychopath because of his need for sadism, violence, and murder to feed his sexuality. By others, he was classified as a high factor 1 psychopath, which means that he was intelligent with very few signs of psychopathy in his childhood. The components of factor 1 psychopathy include a grandiose sense of self, pathological lying, conning manipulative behaviors, lack of remorse, lack of empathy, and failure to accept responsibility. That's why Bundy insisted on his innocence until death and used various tricks to delay the trial. While he was an intelligent psychopath, it was noted that he was very insecure, shy, and feared humiliation. Dr. Lewis initially diagnosed him with bipolar disorder, but after analyzing interviews and the evidence presented in court, also proposed that he may have had dissociative identity disorder, previously named multiple personality disorder. Interviewers, prison wardens, and Ted's great aunt all shared accounts of when they saw him become another person, where it felt like they were suddenly standing beside a stranger in the room. He was able to change his facial expressions, body posture, and mannerisms so drastically that it aided him in convincing his family, friends, and police officers that he was not the killer they were looking for. Some experts have argued that these shifts and changes could still be in line with behaviors seen in those with antisocial personality disorder, where their superficial charm and charisma is merely a facade for the cold-hearted, empty vessel underneath. Bipolar disorder. Source, psychiatry.org. Bipolar disorders are brain disorders that cause changes in a person's mood, energy, and ability to function. Bipolar disorder is a category that includes three different conditions: bipolar 1, bipolar 2, and cyclothymic disorder. People with bipolar disorders have extreme and intense emotional states that occur at distinct times, called mood episodes. These mood episodes are categorized as manic, hypomanic, or depressive. People with bipolar disorders generally have periods of normal mood as well. Bipolar disorders can be treated, and people with these illnesses can lead full and productive lives. Dissociative Identity Disorder. Source, psychiatry.org. Dissociative identity disorder is associated with overwhelming experiences, traumatic events, and/or abuse that occurred in childhood. Dissociative identity disorder was previously referred to as multiple personality disorder. Symptoms of dissociative identity disorder, criteria for diagnosis, include the existence of two or more distinct identities or personality states. The distinct identities are accompanied by changes in behavior, memory, and thinking. The signs and symptoms may be observed by others or reported by the individual. Ongoing gaps in memory about everyday events, personal information, and/or past traumatic events. The symptoms cause significant distress or problems in social, occupational, or other areas of functioning. In addition, the disturbance must not be a normal part of a broadly accepted cultural or religious practice. As noted in the DSM-5, in many cultures around the world, experiences of being possessed are a normal part of spiritual practice and are not dissociative disorders. The attitude and personal preferences, for example, about food, activities, clothes of a person with dissociative identity disorder, may suddenly shift and then shift back. The identities happen involuntarily and are unwanted and cause distress. People with dissociative identity disorder may feel that they have suddenly become observers of their own speech and actions, or their bodies may feel different, example, like a small child, like the opposite gender, huge and muscular. The Sidran Institute notes that a person with dissociative identity disorder feels as if they have within them two or more entities, each with its own way of thinking and remembering about themselves and their life. It is important to keep in mind that although these alternate states may feel or appear to be very different, they are all manifestations of a single, whole person. Other names used to describe these alternate states include alternate personalities, alters, states of consciousness, and identities. For people with dissociative identity disorder, the extent of problems functioning can vary widely, from minimal to significant problems. People often try to minimize the impact of their symptoms. While Bundy confessed to 30 murders, he did not ever take responsibility for them, instead always shifting blame onto other factors that may have contributed to his behavior. For example, he convinced Dr. James Dobson, a psychologist and evangelical church leader, that pornography was the cause of his violent behavior. But in interviews with Stephen Michaud, expressed how little pornography had to do with the outcome of his actions. He frequently contradicted himself and manipulated every audience that he ever had. Professor Wittiger from the Department of Psychology at the University of Kentucky said, "He was, for the most part, emotionally stable. A trait common to all psychopaths is the ability to be deceptive, to lie with ease. The classic phrase in psychopathy literature is that they wear a mask of sanity." Of course, he was also diagnosed with sexual paraphilia, necrophilia, sadism, and a host of other disorders that made up his complex and destructive mind. In essence, Bundy was a power control killer who reveled in the feeling of dominating his victims. He was patient and enjoyed the process of torturing and slowly killing those that he took to isolated locations, raping and humiliating them, and finally murdering them in cold blood. He decided how, when, and under what circumstances his victims would die. While he sexually assaulted all of his victims, his primary motive was not lust, but power. This is also evident by his return to their corpses to continue his display of power and rage even after death. The necrophilia was a way of channeling his internal need for ultimate power and the release of lifelong rage and resentment. It eliminated the possibility of rejection, where he could return to enjoy them when he wanted to and how he wanted to. Sexual disorders, paraphilia. For Ted Bundy, his paraphilias included voyeurism, peeping Tom, pedophilia, sexual focus on children, hebephilia, sexual focus on adolescence, necrophilia, sexual focus on corpses, and cannibalism, sexual focus on consuming parts of people. Paraphilia refers to any intense and persistent sexual interest other than sexual interest in genital stimulation or preparatory fondling with phenotypically normal, physically mature, consenting human partners. Was Bundy satisfied after each murder? He said, "The fantasy that accompanies and generates the anticipation that precedes the crime is always more stimulating than the immediate aftermath of the crime itself," which was his way of explaining the chronic longing for a sense of satisfaction, no matter how many murders he committed. He vividly fantasized about the perfect murder and was always left feeling disappointed that it did not play out exactly as he had imagined it in his mind. He would have continued to kill cyclically with a never-ending desire to achieve his ideal fantasy without any remorse. He took Polaroids of his victims, kept trophies, jewelry, ID cards, a lock of hair, bones, etc., and continuously refueled his violent sexual urges and dark compulsions. When asked why he took Polaroids, he said, "When you work hard to do something right, you don't want to forget it." Bundy spoiled his girlfriends with gifts of the jewelry taken from his victims, saying, "Look what I found on the street. I want you to have it." He took great pleasure in seeing them wear it, his secret rape and murder memento on full display, even saying, "If she only knew that the necklace she's wearing came from someone I murdered," with a smirk. The fact that he was able to succeed academically, politically, and in his personal life while sustaining a gruesome serial killing career will never cease to fascinate the world. If there ever was a successful psychopath or perfect killing machine, Ted Bundy was it. He even described himself as the most cold-hearted son of a bitch you'll ever meet. Childhood. Theodore Robert Cowell, Ted Bundy, was born at the Elizabeth Lund Home for Unwed Mothers on November 24, 1946, in Burlington, Vermont. His mother was 22 years old and unmarried, which was considered a scandal in those days. Her father, Samuel Cowell, urged her to have an abortion, but due to her religious beliefs, she could not bring herself to do it. Instead, she contemplated the next best option, which would be giving her son up for adoption, something that the home offered. She did, in fact, decide to leave her little boy there, where he was taken care of by the home's staff for the first 3 months of his life. If we consider the attachment theory, this separation from his mother would have had an enormous impact on his psychology and would have put him at risk for developing complex personality disorders and irregular behaviors in later life. Perhaps Louise sulked at home, longing for her son, or perhaps a sense of pride filled Samuel Cowell. Whatever the reason was, he suddenly insisted that she go back to the home to collect her son, where he would be raised as his own to eliminate any shame that could be directed their way. Who was Ted Bundy's father? Family members have long suspected that Samuel Cowell, the abusive father of Louise, was Ted's biological father, which could very well be the case. It certainly seems plausible, even when you consider that Louise mentioned two names for who she believed the father was: Lloyd Marshall, an Air Force veteran, and Jack Worthington, a war veteran. These gentlemen have never surfaced, and the popular opinion is that they may have never existed. Ironically, Louise was as secretive about the identity of her son's father as Ted was about his murders. Once Teddy was brought home, Samuel and Eleanor Cowell raised him as their own son, while his mother, Louise, fulfilled the role as an elder sister. Samuel was a tyrant filled with rage, violence, and dark sexual urges, storing a stash of pornography outside in his tool shed, which Ted allegedly got hold of at the young age of 3. He watched as his father swung cats by their tails, shouted at his workers, and blazed criticism at his wife and daughters for anything and everything. This father figure would leave a lasting impression on Ted's mind, one that soft and kind Johnny Culpepper Bundy could never erase. His mother, grandmother, was also not fit to take care of him, suffering from major anxiety and depression, for which she received electroconvulsive therapy. She was meek and traumatized by her husband, and definitely would not have had the capacity to nurture little Ted. When he was 3 years old and had grown close to his family, mimicking his grandfather in many ways, Louise decided, at the urging of other family members, that she needed to take her son away to a safer environment to grow up. This was allegedly shortly after Ted had placed a range of butcher's knives around his aunt's body as she napped one afternoon, smiling at her from the edge of the bed as she stirred, woke up, and saw the scene, terrified. Louise must have realized that her father and the home that she was watching her son grow up in was creating a monster, one that she underestimated. Louise packed up her things and took her toddler to Tacoma, Washington, where they stayed with her cousins for a while. This would have had a big impact on Ted's psychology and would have left a huge void in his mind, where his only very memorable father figure was suddenly ripped out of his life. He was forced to glide into a new life with his elder sister, where his little mind soon began to question things. He expressed in interviews that he had already suspected that Louise was his mother at the time, because it just made more sense. He allegedly called her Mommy for the first time when he was 3 years old, shortly before departing for Tacoma. Once they had moved, Louise changed his surname to Nelson, a very odd decision indeed. Where and why did she come up with that surname? She seemed adamant to disassociate him from Samuel Cowell, which leaves more evidence as to what the truth was lurking in the family's closet. In 1951, when Ted was 5 years old, Louise met Johnny Culpepper Bundy and married him later that year. Ted allegedly stuck his hands into the wedding cake. This meant another swift move into a new home for Ted, as well as a brand new man in his life that wanted to be his dad. His surname was changed for the second time in his life, this time to Bundy. A name change might seem like a trivial thing, but it has a shattering impact on a child's identity and self-image. He withdrew completely and showed little interest in bonding with his new father, as much as Johnny tried. He was an only child for the first 6 years of his life before siblings were introduced into his world in the Bundy house, the first being Linda Bundy, born in 1952, followed by Glenn, born in 1954, Sandra, born in 1956, and Richard, born in 1961. Oddly, Ted would eventually get along most with the youngest child, Richard, but that took several years to accomplish. Because Ted was so quiet and withdrawn, Louise and Johnny focused the majority of their energy on the younger and more demanding children, leaving him to his own devices for much of the time. The house was small, and income was limited, which meant Ted essentially had less and less resources as the family grew. Johnny was a hospital cook, previously a cook in the military, so there was not a lot of anything to go around, especially with Louise having to stay home to look after her 5 children. Ted resented this and missed his life with his grandfather, which in his mind was wealthier and more established, something that he had all to himself. This mindset could have had some influence in wanting his victims all to himself, especially in the sense of how he murdered them and had sex with their corpses for as long as possible, i.e. greed was growing unnoticed in his mind, thriving by the time that he was a teenager. The Bundys went on many family holidays, which included fishing, camping, hiking, and outdoorsy activities, which Ted learned to love. He enjoyed the solitude that wide open spaces offered him, another puzzle piece in his complex mind that formed part of his MO as a serial killer. Adolescence. In 1958, Ted was enrolled at Hunt Junior High, shifting to Wilson High for his sophomore year in 1962 until he graduated in 1965. He said, "I always felt I was too small. This feeling began to emerge in junior high school that I didn't have the weight or physique for sports, and it was very costly to buy the uniforms. My family didn't always have the money, so I was all on my own. It was a source of some agony." For the majority of his high school career, he was friends with a boy called Jerry Bullett, who shared his love of skiing. They enjoyed skiing at Snoqualmie Pass, but Ted's family certainly did not have the resources to fund his new expensive hobby, which was the start of kleptomania for him. His skiing equipment and ski lift passes were stolen, much like the crutches, uniforms, and kill kit accessories that he used to lure and murder people were stolen. While Ted blended in well in elementary school, he fell behind socially in high school, saying that he just didn't quite know how to fit in. He said, "In junior high, everything was fine, even went to some parties. Nothing I can recall happened that summer before my sophomore year to stunt me or otherwise hinder my progress. But I got to high school and I didn't make any progress." In other interviews, he said, "In high school, I would be characterized as introverted. A lot of my pretensions about being a scholarly type was really a defense mechanism because I couldn't achieve those kinds of social goals I wanted." Sandy Holt, a childhood friend who knew him from when she was 5 years old until she was 15, and who was interviewed on the Netflix documentary about him, provided insight into the dark psychology that boiled inside him from an early age. According to her, he did not fit in at all, wore short shorts that he was frequently bullied about, had a terrible speech impediment which made him hard to understand, and said that he was a sadist then already, to animals and other children. She explained how he tortured a neighborhood cat, just like his grandfather taught him to. He hung one of the stray cats in the neighborhood from one of the clotheslines in the backyard, doused it in lighter fluid, and set it on fire, and I heard that cat squealing, and by the time somebody got out there with a hose, the cat was gone. That was just too much shock for the poor thing. He also led young children into the woods, made them strip, and then ran off with their clothes, terrorizing them. He'd hear them screaming for blocks. I mean, no matter where we were, we could hear them screaming, she said. He started listening to an evening radio talk show, KGO in San Francisco, when he was around 12 years old. Sometimes until the early hours of the morning, and practiced all the various accents he heard. He formulated questions that he would have asked had he been the host, and practiced the responses, and perfected the art of mimicking behaviors, tone of voice, and characters, a skill that served him well to stay under the radar as a serial killer in later life. The talk show offered him company during the night, something that shaped him as a night owl with eccentricities. As a teenager going through puberty, Ted struggled to process his sexuality and was frequently teased by his peers for his problem with chronic masturbation. He scoured his neighborhood at night looking for pornographic content in trash cans and settled for a while on voyeurism, something that was sparked by being able to see into a bathroom of a house across from his. He said, "I mean, among my sexual activities was to look out of my bedroom window, which looked down into the neighbor's bathroom. Nothing really harmful or threatening, but things which, because I was totally on my own and wasn't sharing this with anybody, nobody could say, 'Gee, that's weird. Don't do that, you see?'" He roamed around at night, often into the woods, peeling his clothes off and running around totally liberated. In an interview with Dr. Dorothy Lewis before he was executed, he said, "Over a 2 or 3 year period, I would go out at night, a warm night. We had some woods in the back of our house. I would take off my clothes and run around the woods. I wasn't flashing on anybody or trying to imagine me stalking anybody, but it was just innocent kind of sport. So there's nothing at this point that's bad, but I see what's happening. I was beginning to get involved in what they would call, developed a preference for what they call autoerotic sexual activity, and that's exactly what it was." Returning home to listen to talk radio in his dreamlike state would not have done his mental health any good, fueling his untethered desires to do just as he pleases. During this crucial period in puberty, he was also delving into detective magazines and pornography, which often depicted women bound or fighting for their life. As simplified as it may seem, what boys fantasize about and nurture during their sexual development has a massive impact on what arouses them throughout their life. And for Ted, it was the woods and frightened or submissive women. He was murdering women mentally before he started to express those urges physically, while simultaneously developing the charm and gentlemanly way that he was known for to attract scores of women. In many regards, Ted Bundy worked exceptionally hard to become the prolific person that he will forever be remembered for, practicing every detail of his compartmentalized life until he got it just right. He became an exceptional con artist who could easily live a double life without even breaking a sweat. He seemed to internalize any perceived or experienced inadequacy and practice overcoming it and perfecting the art of being the very best at whatever it was. For example, in high school, he only went on one date, which did not result in having a girlfriend, even though he was well acquainted with girls in school. It seems that Ted worked his butt off to get permanently out of the friend zone and into the pants of several women by the time he was a young adult, which is somewhat of an achievement for a shy, sensitive boy with a speech impediment. Perhaps that is what is most disturbing about Ted Bundy. He worked hard at everything he did, striving for perfection even in murder, victim discard, and necrophilia. Once he had set his mind on something, nothing could stop him. He would achieve it at all costs. High school friend Terry Storwick described Ted's loneliness and sense of not belonging in high school, where peers would walk up to Terry and invite him to a party, neglecting to ask Ted. He said, "Ted would be standing there, and he wouldn't be asked. It wasn't that he was singled out for ridicule, but you have to remember that Ted was a very sensitive person, very sensitive. His high school feelings of being a loser or an outcast became an obsession to be invited to the most exclusive parties in the world, political ones." Every achievement and milestone in his political journey must have carved a huge smile on his face. where he felt that he had conquered and annihilated the immaturity of high school social norms. An "I'll show you" attitude dominated Ted's thinking in every facet of his life. In his senior year, 1965, he was arrested twice for activities related to auto theft and burglary, which earned him a criminal record that was expunged when he turned 18, which is common practice in Washington. Juvenile caseworkers were aware of Ted Bundy in his adolescence, something that his parents did not ever talk about. This was revealed in hindsight as the world tried to figure out what went wrong and how or when. High school peers and friends had no knowledge of his thievery, which demonstrates the early age at which he started compartmentalizing his behavior, hiding it in plain sight. His primary motive for stealing was to raise his class, where he was from a lower to middle class family and always striving to be part of the upper class crowd. In his teenage years, he tried out for many sports teams but was never picked, which bruised his fragile ego. In his senior year, Ted worked as a volunteer for a local political race, which is when he realized how powerful his political persona could be. He glided easily through political circles, using his knowledge on communication and accents to his full advantage in a setting where it thrived, unlike his other social experiences. In an interview, he explained, "Politics gave me a lot. It gave me a direction and an education in a lot of things tangential to politics, things I needed to know. In politics, you can move between the various strata of society. You can talk and mingle with people to whom otherwise you would have absolutely no access." He'd found a way to top even his upper-class social skiing world, feeling even more at home and in control in politics. He graduated from Woodrow Wilson High with a 3.02 average out of 4, and by the end of the year was enrolled in the University of Puget Sound to study Chinese. Adulthood. Ted spent most of his 20s studying, dating, skiing, working in politics, and of course, serial killing, before he was first arrested for murder when he was 29. He completed 1 year of studies in Chinese, earned a bachelor's degree in psychology, and was studying towards a law degree when he was apprehended in 1975. Ted Bundy was the all-American psycho, one that nobody would ever suspect of the heinous crimes that he committed. He was a success in politics, worked many meaningful jobs, which included working for a suicide prevention organization, assisting the Seattle crime prevention team to create rape prevention brochures, and being the assistant chairman on Rockefeller's Republican presidential campaign. Perhaps the most terrifying aspect of Ted Bundy is how normal he seemed, and on a far deeper level than most serial killers. He was healthy, successful, romantic, and influential, which isn't quite the norm for serial killers. Stephen Michaud pointed out that while Bundy has always been described as an attractive, intelligent, and charming individual, what should have also been mentioned was that he was a compulsive nose picker, nail biter, and an untraveled, poorly read man with fairly average academic performance. His IQ was 136, though, which puts him in the top 2% of the population in the world. It's shocking to watch his every move on reruns of his interviews and still not quite see how he could have done what he did in his double life. He was a well-spoken, groomed, sarcastic, and entertaining guy, one that many women fell in love with even when he was sentenced to death. It's incredible to think that a man with such potential for politics and power almost got away with murder. Imagine if he had managed to defend himself successfully, for example, if he did not leave such incriminating bite marks on Lisa Levy's buttocks. When Ted was 21 years old, he was already neck deep in compulsive voyeurism. Statistically, up to 80% of voyeurs go on to commit violent crimes, such as rape or murder. For Ted, he did precisely that, fueled with lust, rage, and mental health complications. It was around this time that he said he began to fully experience an entity in his mind that he believed could be described as demon possession. He went on to say that he believes all serial killers are demon possessed, which could be one way to describe mental illness. Bundy's entity manifested as a voice in his head that would argue with him, like a dialogue between two people, and that he would try to ignore it or overcome its urges and desires. Over time, he conditioned himself to tolerate it, even though he felt that he was completely opposite to this person. Talking about himself in third person, which is unusual, he said, "The early manifestations of this condition, which is an interest concerning sexual images, your standard fare that you'd see in a movie house or a Playboy magazine, the interest becomes skewed towards a more specialized literature, some of it pretty grotesque, which would preoccupy him more and more. It would reach a point where the anger, the frustration, the anxiety, the poor self-image, feeling cheated, wronged, insecure, he decides upon young, attractive women being his victims." This description of himself comes across as far more accurate than demon possession, rather describing the process of mental deterioration where his mind simply gave in to his overwhelming sexual desires and the need for ego replenishment. Interestingly, Bundy had a pattern of committing his crimes after experiencing some form of stressor in his life, whether it was financial, academic performance related, or disappointing experiences in his relationships with women. In the interviews for his infamous confession tapes, which is now a Netflix series, he told Stephen Michaud that the feeling in him continued to grow until this malignant entity controlled him, and he just did what it told him to do. That would be the easier option, wouldn't it? And we are all frequently guilty of choosing pleasure over progress. But for Bundy, it meant the choice between life and death, and not veggies or fries. When Michaud pressed on and asked what he thought this entity was, Ted went into the defense, making sure that he understood that it was not a matter of split personality or schizophrenia, but a far more complex idea. He referred to it as a hybrid situation and described it as purely a destruction that grew from within. Bundy had a psychology degree, so his confessions and the hours worth of interviews were fascinating to listen to. However, as complex as he tried to make it all sound, he was not immune to the DSM-5, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, and was suspected of having dissociative identity disorder, previously known as multiple personality disorder. He was formally diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder and bipolar disorder, but many specialists still analyze his case today, fascinated by the psychology that he presented. Samuel Cowell, Ted's grandfather, and possibly father, was known to talk to and shout at invisible entities, which could mean that there was a dormant gene of schizophrenia in Ted's DNA when he was born. Either way, no matter what psychological profile a person falls under, it is never an excuse to commit murder. There is always a choice, no matter how one looks at it. Let's take a look at Ted's shape-shifting behavior as an adult, based on accounts from those who knew him. Elizabeth Klipfer was his girlfriend from 1969 to 1976, 7 years, and authored her own book about her experience with Bundy, titled The Phantom Prince, My Life with Ted Bundy. In it, she described seeing a different side of him when she confronted him about stolen or suspicious items, such as the crutches in his apartment, his skiing equipment, and the lug wrench that he made a grip for. He said, "Tell anyone, and I'll break your fucking neck." On one occasion, the couple went river rafting on a day outing, which they both looked forward to. While on the river, Ted's face suddenly changed, and he pushed Liz into the icy waters. She tumbled in, looking back at him in total shock, but saw only a vacant expression on his face. "As if he couldn't even see me," she said. She described feeling like he was no longer there, and it scared her to see him like that. Once composite drawings had been made of a Ted with a Volkswagen as a suspect for multiple murders, Liz's alarm bells went off. She started thinking about the plaster of Paris she saw in his apartment, the crutches, and other mysteries that he had casually explained away at the time. It's a pity that Ted had so cleverly disguised himself and convinced the police that he was innocent that they did not take her phone calls about him seriously. When he was eventually incarcerated for the third time, this time in Florida where capital punishment was in effect, he called her from prison and explained the entity to her. She tried to make sense of it by asking, "Ted, are you saying you're sick?" He said that tragically he was sick, had been for a long time, and that he was completely consumed by something that he didn't understand, and that he just couldn't contain it. Stephen Michaud eerily recalled how Bundy's eyes would turn completely black when he spoke about his crimes, as if he was a monster fueled by lust and murder. As ominous as this sounds, it was most likely his pupils dilating from adrenaline and excitement to such a degree that his blue eyes appeared black. This is a common pattern in psychopaths, which Ted most certainly was. Serial killers usually revel in their crimes, keeping special trophies and photographs to help them relive the experience again and again. Ted kept jewelry, Polaroids, locks of hair, clothing, and parts of his victims' corpses, expressing how much sexual satisfaction it brought him to relive. When the defense investigator, Joe Alloy, interviewed Bundy in prison, he described his shape-shifting as a change in energy in the room, like a negative electricity, and said that a foul odor emanated from Bundy when he had fully transitioned into this entity. This account sounds like something one might expect from demon possession, but when looked at from a more logical standpoint, perhaps it's a way of describing the terrifying experience of seeing someone change completely before their very eyes, something which is common in observers of dissociative identity disorder in clinical settings. Even if we just look at Bundy's physical attributes, he was incredibly good at changing his appearance so that he was unrecognizable at times. Whether it was a mustache, parting his hair a different way, drastically losing weight, or changing his posture, tone, and facial expressions, he was quite the chameleon, a skill that he relied on to stay out of trouble for as long as possible. His adult life was his downfall, and his masterpiece. It is what we will always remember him by. That mesmerizing collision of ambition and greed, which he delicately balanced to sculpt the grandiose character that he will forever be. Sexuality. As we know, at a very young age, Ted Bundy had already been exposed to pornography and violence, where himself and a cousin had snuck into his grandfather's tool shed and relished in the magazines they found hidden in it. Samuel Cowell was not a man who respected women. Instead, verbally and physically abusing them and treating them like objects. This had a lasting impact on Ted, especially because it was his first impression of a man and father figure. He said, "Women are possessions, beings which are subservient more often than not to males. Women are merchandise," which mirrors the belief that Samuel Cowell had of women. When asked a question related to sex education, he said, "My mother and I didn't talk a lot about real personal matters, certainly never about sex or anything like that. She doesn't open up and explain." It's a subtle way of admitting that no one really ever sat him down and explained sex to him, and he was left to explore its realms all by himself, which is not unusual. By the time Ted was a teenager, he was an uncontrollable voyeur and chronic masturbator, where he sometimes had to lock himself in the broom cupboard at school to masturbate, which he was bullied about. He also developed a sock fetish, something that had even crept into his adult life and was presented as evidence in court. The credit cards that he had stolen from women's purses after escaping prison were used to buy dozens of pairs of socks. He told Stephen Michaud in interviews that he felt nothing but pride to see all those socks arrayed before the jury, like a cattleman surveying his prize herd. He also said, "I have always felt deprived of underwear. This is for real. I mean, I've got a sock fetish. I'm really sick when it comes to socks. Those are some of the things for people who really want to know what makes Ted Bundy tick. I'm very close to my feet. They're probably the most attractive feet you've ever seen. Socks are such a serious part of my life." His favorite? Burlington's. While accounts of when and how he first had sex vary, his confession revealed that he lost his virginity to Diane Edwards, his first love. And when she eventually broke off the relationship, it shattered him. He said, "I had the overwhelming feeling of rejection that stemmed not just from her, but everything. The tail end of that summer is really a blank. I mean, it was a nightmare for me. In there somewhere was to have some sort of revenge on Diane." Many have speculated that his victims were women who resembled Diane in some way, whether it was their parted hair, financial status, or maturity, which does seem to be an accurate assumption to make. As an adult, Ted indulged in brothels and strip clubs while feeding his sexual urges with violent pornography and fantasies. By the time he had started regularly murdering women, his necrophiliac tendencies had taken over, where he hungered for more and more control and power with each sexual experience that he had. Necrophilia, sexual intercourse with or attraction towards corpses, is in one sense the ultimate control over a person, where they cannot reject or insult you, but are left to simply be subjected to whatever the necrophiliac wants to do to one's flesh. It is the ultimate form of objectification, where a person is so dehumanized that they become whatever the offender wants them to be. He decapitated many of his victims and left their bodies in the woods to be gnawed by animals. Bundy enjoyed the fact that nature did the work for him and often took jewelry, clothing, or severed heads home as trophies. He also posed his victims' bodies in ways that reflected his pornographic taste and took Polaroids of them to keep. Some have even speculated that he was aroused in court when the Polaroids and crime scene photos were produced as evidence. In later confessions, Bundy admitted that he did also cannibalize some of his victims to completely possess them, something that one might expect from a serial killer who is escalating his thrills. He apparently washed some of the severed head's hair and reapplied makeup before engaging in necrophilia at his apartment, and often revisited the corpses for weeks after the victim had been murdered, where he could lie with them, talk to them, and gain some form of closeness with them. Sometimes his need for power and control manifested as pedophiliac, where he would target young girls, much like his last victim, 12-year-old Kimberly Leach. His stepdaughter, Molly, daughter of Liz Klopfer, wrote her own book about growing up with Bundy as her dad, saying that he taught her to ride her bicycle, ski, and did all the normal dad things with her. But he also crept into her bed a couple of times, according to her book, and slipped his fingers into her underwear, where she vividly remembered saying, "You peed," not realizing that his pants were wet for other reasons. He also took pictures of her naked in the bathtub and exposed himself to her when she was 7 years old, which was the first time that she had ever seen a man's genitals. She said that he was very playful and often put her in a crotch hold as they played, something that she had not realized was not normal. He came up with a lot of games to play with her, one which she remembered clearly. Bundy had covered himself with a blanket and prompted her to reveal a surprise. When she pulled the blanket off him, she saw that he was completely naked. "I can turn invisible, but my clothes can't, and I didn't want you to see me," he said, which made no sense to her. He then ran to one of the bases that he had designated, which just so happened to be the shower. When she chased him, he fell to his knees on the bathroom floor and covered his parts with his hands. The curious Molly kept playing along and tugged at his hands, which revealed a reddish-purple erection. She asked if it hurt, and what happened next is very creepy. "He stopped laughing and looked up at me, but something wasn't right. The pupils of his eyes had become tiny, almost as small as the point of a pencil, and each one looking in a slightly different direction. I saw something new seeing me, something dangerous with those reptile-like eyes." Bundy suffered from an inferiority complex and decided that the best way to gain power was to totally possess and control women who were beautiful, intelligent, and quite the opposite of his mother. Ted did not like that wealthy, privileged women were, in effect, his equal, and were also getting educated and rising to the top of their chosen career paths. He was only used to being around totally submissive women who were not a threat to his ego and who built him up, whereas many of his victims would not have given him the time of day. He chillingly described how he treated murder like a sport, where he would sometimes have practice runs by picking up women and letting them go. The practice of self-control in these situations made the high even better for him when he did decide to totally let go. He was also a biter, nicknamed the Love Biter in the media for a time because he savagely tore off women's nipples with his teeth and bit their legs and buttocks. The sex he had with his longtime girlfriends were, according to them, very normal, some even describing it as fading into memory for not being all that spectacular. He enjoyed humiliating them in public by dunking them underwater, untying their bikini tops, and having sex in areas that could have exposed them. This was the same exhibitionism he enjoyed in prison, where he pushed Carol Ann Boone up against a water cooler during visits and likely got a high from the guards walking in on them a couple of times, as Carol explained. In a letter to Anne Rule, the author of The Stranger Beside Me, he wrote, "I am undeniably dependent on women, given birth by a woman, taught in school by women, and deeply, deeply in love with one woman. However, she noted that he could switch from being warm and tender to hostile and disrespectful in an instant." Spirituality. Ted Bundy's mother, Louise, was a devout Methodist Christian her whole life and married a man of faith, Johnny Culpepper Bundy, in 1951. This meant that Ted was taken along to church every Sunday throughout his youth, even becoming the vice president of the local Methodist youth leadership during his teenage years. While he may not have been a very spiritual person, he certainly took all the right actions to portray himself as a faithful man. When he worked in politics, Bundy must have portrayed himself as a man of faith, often the demeanor and facade required for political success. Nelson Rockefeller, who Bundy worked for, was a devout Baptist and teetotaler who supported many Christian organizations. For Bundy to have been appointed the assistant chairman on Rockefeller's presidential campaign means that he portrayed himself as a man in line with Rockefeller's beliefs and values. In August or September of 1974, shortly after arriving in Salt Lake City to study law at the University of Utah, Ted Bundy met two members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints when they knocked on his door and struck up a conversation about faith. He told them that he would be very interested in joining the church, likely a strategy to cover his murderous tracks, and within 1 year of socializing and integrating into the community, he was officially baptized by missionary Larry Anderson. He went on some outings with LDS members and formed sufficient positive bonds to convince the congregation that, despite his struggle with alcohol and marijuana, that he was innocent of the crimes he was being accused of in the Carol Durant trial. The group even made him a card to wish him strength and courage for the trial, knowing that he was totally innocent. After his third and final trial and subsequent death sentence, he bluntly stated how little remorse he had for his crimes. "I don't feel guilty for any of it. I feel less guilty now than I felt at any time in my whole life. About anything, I mean really, and it's not like I've forgotten anything or I've closed down a part of my mind or compartmentalized. I believe I understand everything that I've done. I am in the enviable position of not having to feel guilt. And that's it. Guilt is this mechanism we use to control people. It's an illusion. It's this kind of social control mechanism, and it's very unhealthy." The day before he was executed, he was interviewed willingly by evangelical reverend and psychologist James Dobson, a final attempt to con someone into believing that he was not to blame for his crimes. In the 45-minute videotaped interview, Bundy looks sullen and humble, which many women empathized with. They saw sadness in his eyes and felt sorry for a man who was tortured by pornography. However, Bundy had done his homework on Dobson and knew that it would be a symbiotic conversation, where Dobson wanted proof of the negative effects of pornography, and Bundy wanted to shift the blame for his heinous crimes. He said, "My experience with pornography that deals on a violent level with sexuality is that once you become addicted to it, and I look at this as a kind of addiction like other kinds of addiction, I would keep looking for more potent, more explicit, more graphic kinds of materials. Like an addiction, you keep craving something which is harder, something which gives you a greater sense of excitement, until you reach the point where pornography only goes so far. Dobson prayed with him before he left, saying that Bundy showed remorse for his crimes and was weeping in his cell. More accurately, he had probably realized that there was no way to escape the electric chair that awaited him the next morning and was crying out of pity for himself. He claimed faith and the forgiveness that comes with it, saying that he had found peace in facing the valley of the shadow of death. FBI Special Agent Bill Hagmeier said that during the days leading up to his executions, Bundy had a pen in his hand and said, "I could stick this so far up my artery it'll squirt in your face, and I'll be drained before anyone even gets here." He refused to let the state kill him, but backed down when Hagmeier asked whether he would be willing to push the envelope with any higher form that might be judging him at the end of his life. "You got me again," Bundy said. And then they read the Bible and prayed together, where Bundy capitalized on his newfound forgiveness for his crimes through his faith in Jesus Christ. While many have speculated whether Bundy was demon-possessed or not during his murders, even Bundy himself said that the entity that he battled with was purely a distraction that grew from within. His degree in psychology offered him a logical, methodical reasoning to his actions, which he described very well himself. The Green River Killer. Gary Ridgway, the Green River Killer, was born on February 18, 1949, the same year as Ted and in the same state. Ridgway joined the Navy and went to Vietnam and on his return started his serial killing career, targeting runaways and prostitutes. He usually took his victims home and strangled them before dumping their bodies in forests or in the river. He returned to some of the corpses to have sex with them, necrophilia, much like Bundy did. Ridgway confessed to 71 murders and was convicted of 49. By 1986, investigators Robert Keppel and Dave Reichert had been working on catching the Green River Killer for years when they received a fascinating letter from Ted Bundy, who was sitting on death row in Florida State Prison, offering his help on the case. Bundy wrote, "Don't ask me why I believe I'm an expert in this area. Just accept that I am, and we'll start from there." He had been reading about the serial killer, calling him the River Man, which inspired the name, while stuck in prison, and found Reichert's name in an article. Robert Keppel had been an investigator on Bundy's case and decided that it would be a worthwhile idea for them to visit him in prison. Keppel said, "Most of the homicide behavioral theorists on the case, especially the hot dogs from the Federal Bureau of Investigation, expected that any day a crazy psycho would be found running down the street with a bloody knife in his mouth. They did not go for the subtlety of the murderer's methods." Bundy made several suggestions, including hosting a slasher film festival, which would provide the perfect observing ground. He also said that they should stake out fresh burial sites, because he believed that serial killers, like him, often returned to them as a matter of pride or for necrophiliac acts, where they could feel that they possessed their victims completely. This would leave fresh evidence behind that could help catch the killer. The most valuable insight that he offered was that killers deliberately placed false evidence or distractions around crime scenes that are unrelated to the crime itself. Something the detectives had not yet considered. Ridgway did, in fact, purposely contaminate his crime scenes with cigarette butts, litter, and gum just to throw detectives off, He sometimes, like Bundy, dumped the body in one site and left it for a few days before relocating it to create a false trail. He reminded detectives that most killers have no remorse and that they take great pride in their work. He also tried to anticipate what the killer would do next, reflecting on his own murders, which Rechert perceived as an attempt to stay in the spotlight, even if just for a moment. It was as if Mr. Bundy was jealous of the attention the Green River Killer was getting, Rechert said. While Ridgway was only caught in 2001, 12 years after Bundy was executed, the interviews between the investigators and him proved to be particularly useful in understanding motives, psychology, and patterns of a serial killer, especially when considering what they did with the victims afterward. Ridgway was caught by matching hair strands and fresh evidence from a burial site that was being closely watched. A posthumous success for the Bundy books. By the time that Ridgway had completed his confessions in exchange for avoiding the death sentence, he became known as America's worst serial killer, who one of the most famous ones helped to catch. Keppel authored a book about his experience titled The River Man, Ted Bundy and I Hunt for the Green River Killer. On one hand, Bundy contributed to society before his death, but on the other, he was a snitch in his own arena, which is quite typical of him.